You're tuning in to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting live from Burnaby Mountain, BC.
Once again, I am Mihai Kovacer. I'm here with two of my regular co-hosts, Brandon Brownlee and Aaron Wang.
I recently went to an event, an installment of the new signature series of the University of British Columbia called UBCO Debates in the Okanagan campus. Great event, some really great points that came up, and the topic was exactly this, is free speech not or is dead? Some great points came up in this debate, and I thought it was really interesting. That being said, I think some of the topics that could have been tackled were not. Some of the more interesting, more contentious topics, which is, you know, fair enough that you might not want to bring that up in a big auditorium with a lot of individuals from the community. I understand that, but I thought it would be interesting to bring some of the ideas I heard there and to put this to my fellow co-hosts. I do want to keep a couple of things in mind as we go along today, which is, I think we can recognize that there are places in the world where free speech suffers far more than it does in Canada. I don't think that's a debate. I think, you know, we know that there are other places in the world where free speech is far more restricted. That being said, I think we have some unique challenges facing us as well when it comes to free speech and getting our opinions out there and getting diverse opinions out there and having access to them. Another thing I want to keep in mind over the course of today's episode is something very interesting that one of the speakers at this event talked about, which was that free speech is not an end, but a means. Free speech was never intended to be like an end in and of itself. And he was suggesting, the speaker, that there is something that we miss or that goes awry when we try to thingify, as he said, free speech, to make it into a thing, when it's not so much a thing as it is a means to other things like democracy, truth, other such ideals that we can strive for. So something to be considered there as we're having this discussion, whether or not this is even a discussion that we can have or should have in exactly the way we're framing it.
I'm actually surprisingly passionate about this subject, and that I think it's a relevant subject. I also think that it's something we need to consider the Canadian context for, because the Canadian law doesn't protect speech the way American law does. And I think this is an unfortunate thing of just the way Canada and America are so enmeshed that most of America, most of the media Canadians consume is American made. They get these ideas about rights in America that I'm not going to say don't exist in Canada, but they certainly don't have the same type of constitutional protections and are not framed in the same words or philosophical or legal intent that they are in America. So in Canada, we don't have a right to free speech. What we do have is a Bill of Rights that lets us have freedom of association and freedom of expression and freedom of conscience. So those are things that are recognized in Canada, but even under that recognition, there are limits put on place. And not to go into too much detail, but we do have hate speech laws in Canada. We do specifically prohibit certain types of speech, and that's very different than the American system. So I think it's important to qualify that the discussion of free speech, while Canada is a tried and true democracy with a long tradition following after the British tradition, we still have a different context. And so I think in general, it's something that I think is very important and critically misunderstood in Canada, because we won't be able to solve our speech problems the way Americans have and will, because we are a different, unique country.
Yeah, absolutely. Just before you jump in there, Brendan, I wanted to say, yeah, that is something that people really should keep in mind. It's something that I went to this debate actually with my girlfriend, and she was sitting beside me. And as soon, like before the debate even started, she leaned over to me and she said, I wonder if they'll talk about the fact that it's different, you know, Canada and the United States have radically different, or if not radically, let's say very significantly different takes on free speech and how to tackle it.
I think about how in classes people are encouraged to give their opinions on certain matters and whatnot, and they do. People don't fail to voice their concerns and opinions in class. I'm not so sure about online. I mean, that is a different domain where different things regulate people's speech or even limit it sometimes. So that might be a bit different. But from my very commonsensical, you know, everyday opinion, it's not dead. It's not worth checking it off and say, okay, things are great, you know, we don't have to worry about it, and that's why we're having this discussion. But I don't know, I don't, if there's a threat to it, I guess it would be worth unpacking that, because it's not obvious to me, is I guess is what I'll say.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, I didn't get this in our official channels, but actually from someone that listens to our show and got back to me after one of our episodes, actually our last episode on Kant and respect. And some of the feedback that I got was along the lines that it would have been nice to hear a stronger stance from some of us, that would have made it a little more engaging, a little easier maybe to dissect information if we're coming at it from two different sides. So in that spirit, I will take the bullet. No, I mean, genuinely from an intellectual standpoint, I will be arguing that free speech, if not dead, is dying. And I don't think that's an irreversible trend, but I think that there are arguments on either side, and we'll get into unpacking those for the remainder of this episode. So first and foremost, I thought it would be interesting to ask whether either of you think that free speech, whether there was ever a golden age of free speech. And this is a question that came up during the debate. There was some audience interaction, and they put this question to us, and then they put it to the people on stage. And I thought it was interesting, because if you look back over the last, let's say, 150 years or something like that, there are different points at which we might say free speech exploded, other times where it was significantly more restricted. I would like to see what you either of you think, if there was ever a golden age of free speech prior to this one, where, let's say, prior to the digital age, because I think that'll be a big part of our conversation, is how does the digital age impact our access to free speech? How does it impact the people we connect to, the people we talk to? So I want to put that question to you first before I offer some of my own thoughts on it. Was there ever a golden age of free speech, maybe, you know, back in the civil rights movement era, or moving forward into the labor rights movements of sort of the 1920s, maybe, you know, in the, again, so 1960s, 70s and civil rights movements, maybe in early days of the internet, the 90s and then early 2000s, but not today.
There were certain periods of American history where there was essentially kind of an explosion of free speech. And this is kind of right before the French Revolution, because ironically, the French Revolution is actually what ends kind of the progression in Europe, I think, towards freedom of speech, because it creates situations of such violence that basically all of the European kingdoms basically decide that, like, this is not the direction we want society to go. I would basically go back to the founding of America and the Enlightenment era of being a time period where free speech emerged in human history. I guess, like, as an ideal of equality, the state or the monarchy should not have the right to go and restrict what people say and or should not say. And I think that a lot of that was in response to specific authors and academics in Europe saying certain things and being told not so discreetly that they were not allowed to say those types of things.
I'm kind of distinguishing between periods where there was a lot of open discussion or there was open communication where there was no suppression of thought, and then periods where there was suppression of thought, but people were willing to resist that. And I feel like both of these feel like moments of freedom of speech, but when you elect something like, you know, the civil rights movement as an era or a golden age of freedom of speech, it seems to fall into one rather than the other. So I guess my contribution here would be, sure, there are golden ages of freedom of speech, and we can kind of see them in these two veins. I think specifically also about Hannah Arendt. She kind of gets accused of being an ancient polis nostalgiaist, where she sees the ancient Greek polis as this era of freedom. It's this sort of like first foray into unfettered political freedom, where people are electing projects and then saying, yes, let's do it. And then they go do that. There isn't really any kind of repression there. There might be some, you know, political forces fighting against them, but they're choosing to go up against them and whatnot. So if I had to think of one, I would think that the era of the ancient Greeks might be a good example. That might also just be because that's the one I'm familiar with reading about through Hannah Arendt. But sure, there have been eras where people have come together and exercised political freedom. And one way of doing that is through speech. And also resisting unjust institutions or whatnot through speech. So I guess that's my contribution, is the ancient Greeks and the polis structure, and also this distinction between open communication and resistance to suppression.
Yeah, you know, I think those are some interesting points. I think what I would point out, and what someone did point out at this debate, was that in terms of, you know, say, assuming that golden age refers to, maybe I should have been more clear about this, like the age that had the most free speech of in all of history, when you frame it that way, one of the speakers made an interesting argument that there never really was such an age compared to today, just in terms of sheer like access to resources. But also, I think what Aaron was pointing out about equality is an interesting one too, because of course before today, I don't mean today, but the last, let's say, 100 years or so, you can, of course, point to examples of people, groups of people, identity groups that were absolutely restricted. By absolutely, I mean, you know, in absolute terms, from participating in the political structure, from having a real voice. And so in that sense, you know, it's hard to compare today to any other time, because if, yes, the people in power had all the freedom of speech and then the rest of the populace didn't, maybe they had more freedom of speech than people in power today in certain contexts, but that's a pretty roundabout framing that I think even so doesn't really stand on its own two feet. So some interesting points there. But I think, again, to bring it back to what I was saying in the beginning, I think what Aaron said is indicative, that free speech, as he was describing it, makes reference to equality, for example, which is one of these ideals that I was talking about, that maybe free speech is not what we're aiming for, but we're aiming for the products of being able to speak freely. So equal access to our, you know, to the public sphere, equality of representation, like I said, things like truth, things like justice. Today we've got pretty free speech, you know, and especially in Canada and in the United States. But I think, again, that comparison is something we should take carefully. let's talk a little bit about what that difference is before we get into the rest of the discussion, because I want to make sure that we're not confusing ourselves here. So in Canada, we live rights society, right? So for those people that maybe aren't familiar with the distinction, positive rights is something where you have a right to something substantive that the state must provide, for example. And there are states in their constitutions that have this. South Africa, for example, has a pretty extensive list of rights that it lists in its constitution. Whether or not such nations always achieve those promised rights is a different question. But the idea, nevertheless, is that there is something substantive there that is to be provided. Whereas in a negative rights scenario, like we have in Canada, it's rather freedom from being stopped or impeded from achieving certain things. So like when you have freedom of association, it's not that the government is promising spaces where you can go and do that, even though it does provide those. It's not that it guarantees them, but it tells you, yeah, no one can stop you from associating. No one can stop you from speaking, from practicing your religion, from what have you. So that's the difference between negative and positive rights. And so what we see is, and the big difference, like Aaron was alluding to, is that in Canada, not only is it, yeah, you have a freedom from being stopped in your speech, from being impeded, but there are also some pretty significant restrictions on that that don't exist in the United States, namely against hate speech. And so this is where, you know, a lot of people that get angry about their speech being restricted get angry because they, for example, that it's not an absolute right, that they're not allowed to say whatever they want whenever they want to. And, you know, that may or may not be a valid claim. Clearly, there are different systems that see differently on this. But an interesting analogy would be to think about it like laws of the road, right? Like, you can't drive however you want, wherever you want, even if you have the right to drive. There are some rules in place to sort of help guide that so you don't hurt anybody. Same thing for advocates of anti-hate speech laws. It's a similar idea. And so I'm not going to take that tack to argue that free speech is dying, but rather that I think there's an important distinction when you talk about who picks those restrictions and how they are enforced. I want to open the floor a little bit to hear. You can jump in whenever you like, by the way, on this. And I'll get into a more specific question in just a moment, but if you have something to add on what I've just said, feel free.
I did want to bring something up because I thought it was a rather relevant modern example. So fairly recently in the UK, I think this was back in 2014, there was a political campaign which was headed up by a bunch of people, but mainly the actor and comedian Rowan Atkinson. And it was basically saying that we need to reform the laws of Britain because at this point in time, the laws, Section 5, included that any speech that could be seen as insulting was considered illegal. And so this political movement was saying, this is going too far. We shouldn't make any speech that can be thought of as insulting illegal just because that is too broad. And they actually, this was proposed law, and I think it actually was law for a certain amount of time. And then it was actually repealed and rolled back in the United Kingdom. So they removed insulting from the legal definition of speech that would not be allowed. I think other examples were speech that incites aggression or and other things like that. So I'm obviously not a legal expert. I want to declare that very, very clearly. I am a undergraduate level person. I don't have a master's degree in any of this, but I do think, and this is something that's been on my mind since I found out about this case, I think it's an interesting thing to consider in terms of Canada's case about whether how Canada should see an insulting speech, whether or not that should be expressly protected, or not protected. Now, I think that is a whole other rabbit hole, and it's not really the place to have that discussion on this specific show, which is a philosophy show. From all of the discussions I've had with my peers, it seems that today what people want is less guarantees of negative rights and more guarantees of positive rights. If you look at the movements that are talking about housing, they should say everyone should have a house. That's a positive right, right? Or they'll say things like, you know, everyone deserves access to this type of service, or this type of, like, everyone deserves like a right to education. So it's very interesting that the language around rights is changing, not just to be in terms of negative rights, but to be in terms of positive rights. And I think a lot of this has to do with ideas that have come up in the UN. There, for instance, there's a document documenting the rights of children that talks very specifically about positive rights and negative rights. So, yeah, I mean, I think we live in a very interesting point in history in a country that does recognize human rights and is, I think, in kind of an exploratory discovery phase in terms of how we want to see that implemented in our society, because we have law that views it from the negative perspective, and then we have people and causes advocating for the positive perspective. And so where that lends out and how we get there will be quite interesting. The last thing I want to say is that it is interesting to think about, and this was a recommendation in the last, there was a public inquiry after a fairly controversial event in Canada, the so-called Freedom Convoy. After the inquiry, there was a discussion. One of the recommendations was by the commission was to potentially create protest green spaces in Canada. So there was a discussion about whether or not the right to protest requires that the government set up certain spaces where people are allowed to protest and allowed to speak. And there are laws in countries like Singapore and the UK, like speakers' corners, which say like these are spaces where people are specifically allowed to say be more free in their speech as they would be in other social situations. So hopefully I haven't dragged us off too far off course, and that provides us some new rabbit holes to dig into.
Yeah, and I do want to get now into the more, I want to preface with the few minutes we have left before halfway, I want to preface some of these discussions about the more contentious issues around free speech. Namely, I want to talk a little bit about cancel culture, and I want to talk a little bit about algorithms. Now, the reason I want to pick these two is because I think they're unique to our age in some respects, especially, I mean, of course, the digital age and algorithms. And though we are, I don't want to just nitpick at definitions, I think it really is important. These factors help us to define what we consider as free speech, and then help us to determine whether or not it's healthy and alive, or needs some support that it isn't getting. And I think the reason for that is, like Aaron is suggesting, if you define it from a positive perspective, it becomes a very different story. I think a lot of people that advocate, that say that free speech is dead, are going to take the tack that, like, oh, I'm not allowed, again, in an absolute sense, to say whatever I want, wherever I want, whenever I want to, or that I'm not given a platform to do that. And I agree that in the negative rights context in which we're living, you don't have a guarantee for a speaking platform aside from just the public sphere, nor do you, of course, in the Canadian context, nor is it the case that you can say certain things that can have really damaging repercussions on other people. And I think there's, you know, so I'm not saying that free speech should be either of those things. That being said, I think that this idea that, especially in the digital realm. So, okay, two things. I want to talk about then for the next half hour, the digital realm and the private versus public sphere. I think this is where the debate gets really interesting, because this is where cancel culture also really rears its head and is a discussion to have, is that what's happened is that a lot of our public fora for speaking are actually private today. And this is a really interesting idea, is that a lot of the places where we have most of our speech, places like social media, are private. They're not public domains. They are private companies. And we have chosen, or in a sense, they have become this way because of our behavior, we have chosen to make them like public spaces where we interact and where we talk to each other. And that's had some really interesting consequences as a result of that. Before we get into those two subjects, though, I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. You can find us at Podbean. That's tcps.podbean.com. And listen to this and other episodes there. So let's talk a bit about the digital age, shall we? We live in a world where we do a lot of our talking on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, Snapchat, LinkedIn. Like, this is where we do a lot of discussing with people. I mean, especially Twitter, I think, is unique in some of these ways, but or X now, I guess. So, you know, we talk a lot on these platforms, which have two interesting challenges. The first is that they're private. So we have this discussion that, like, oh, we should be protecting free speech, and it's restricted in some of these domains. But these private companies have no responsibility towards us to provide us with that level of, you know, protection that the government, for example, has. And this is a discussion we could have. For example, should they be taking on some of these responsibilities, or are we using them in such a way that demands them to change and to provide certain protections for these speeches? In another sense, should we maybe be creating government-run, or in public, I should say, spaces online where these protections do exist and where our speech is protected? Fun fact, CBC was supposed to be that on the internet, the web version of cbc.ca when it was first launched, was intended to be a sort of communal blog conversation space where the people running the site, like one of them was the person that made that site, actually was one of the debaters at this debate. And she was saying, yeah, her vision was to have a space where maybe they, you know, she could launch some prompts out at, you know, for people and sort of moderate or guide discussion in some way. But it was meant to be a real, like, public forum for discussion. Of course, it didn't end up being that, but there's some interesting thoughts there. And this is where I stake my first argument that free speech is dying, is that we're giving our free speech, we're giving our right to free speech, we're putting it in domains where it doesn't have the protections that I believe it should have for it to be completely free. So anyways, I've talked a lot. I'll leave some room here for my host to jump in.
Yeah, and actually I was going to kind of meld the two, what Aaron said earlier about this idea of...
I muted you there by accident. I was coming for myself.
It's okay. This idea of providing green spaces, I think you called it, Aaron, to protesters. Well, just what would that look like on the internet? I mean, it would, like, a pop up and say, hey, here's this thing you could listen to. Sure. I mean, the internet is the speeding up of telecommunications. It's complete. It's linear in that sense. It's a graphically organized document, and it's not spatial. In virtual space is not spatial in the same way that, you know, quote unquote real space is space. So you have translating political space into virtual space, politicized, it doesn't translate perfectly. So there's that. And But to go on to this distinction between the public and private, I think that's really important, that it seems, and it seems that though this